You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is Jade Dellinger, who since 2013 has been director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College, formerly Edison State College in Fort Myers, Florida. Fort Myers is just across the causeway from Captiva Island, where Robert Rauschenberg lived for nearly four decades up until his death in 2008. Since 2012, Captiva has also been home to the Rauschenberg Residency. Dellinger has embarked on a number of gallery exhibitions involving the work of John Cage, including a lively installation of his Things Not Seen Before, a tribute to John Cage with 33 and a third, performed by audience, a visual art exhibition and interactive installation first seen at the Tampa Museum of Art in celebration of Cage's centenary. Consisting largely of material not previously exhibited, much created specifically for this project, Things Not Seen Before includes Cage-related or inspired works by colleagues and collaborators, including Fluxus pioneers Nam June Paik, Philip Korner, Giuseppe Chiari, Yoko Ono, and Milan Knicksack. Numerous others who closely followed or befriended and were profoundly influenced by Cage, Laurie Anderson, David Byrne, The Art Guys, Lee Rinaldo, Christina Kubich, Andrew Deutsch, Stephen Vitiello, and Christian Marclay were also featured. Plus, several original pieces, artist conks, and more about those later, Masostic manuscripts and early lithographs, all created by Cage, were positioned on gallery walls, making use of the artist's own rather unorthodox chance operations. Things Not Seen Before also featured a special interactive installation of Cage's 33 and a third. As Dellinger described it, Cage conceived 33 and a third in 1969 as a visitor participation piece, encouraging gallery visitors to engage freely with a room full of record players and stacks of vinyl LPs. However, as the composer never specified LP titles for use in the installation, a prominent group of what he called guest curators were invited to submit top 10 picks to fill record bins in the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery. Dellinger's guest curators included Iggy Pop, Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo, Richie Ramone from the Ramones, Pauline Oliveros, Meredith Monk, John Baldessari, William Wegman, Graham Nash, Brian Ferry from Roxy Music, Joan LaBarbera, David Harrington from the Kronos Quartet, Vito Acconci, Matthew Barney, Jim Rosenquist, Ed Richey, and others. In 2019, Dellinger also hosted an enactment of John Cage's Steps, a composition for a painting, 1989, within the context of a celebratory exhibition for the gallery's 40th anniversary entitled John Cage, Steps, and Other Works from the Mountain Lake Workshop, an exhibition of visual art that featured not only newly licensed performances of Steps, but also the world premiere showing of Cage's New River Rocks and Washes from 1990. The score for Steps, by the way, was created by Cage collaborator Ray Cass, longtime director of the Mountain Lake Workshop, where Cage himself conceived of and first performed Steps, and also created his significant body of watercolors, known as the New River Watercolors in 1988 and River Rocks and Smoke in 1990. Cass's score for Steps enables future performances across artistic media and is available from Cage's music publisher, C.F. Peters, Edition Peters. Jade has had an amazing history, and his arrival at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery in 2013 was almost inevitable. As you'll hear, he has lots of stories to tell. So this is part one of a two-part program, which will culminate with part two on July 17. So welcome to All Things Cage, Jade. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Laura. It's really a treat to be here, and I'm honored by the invitation.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I was trying to remember today before our call, what was the first occasion that I met you? And I believe it was in 2012 when you were preparing the show called Things Not Seen Before with Tempest Projects in Tampa.
That's precisely it. I think we had a few emails just in advance of that during kind of preparations. And that was a project that really came out of the celebrations for Cage's centenary, as you know. So, and with it, it really, I had been doing independent curating at that point and was working both with the Contemporary Art Museum at the University of South Florida, where Cage had been and, you know, at various times, but also then with the Tampa Museum of Art. And I had proposed maybe a year prior a project for the Tampa Museum. And as I had always sort of liked to do when doing projects for either of those two institutions, I wanted to find ways to support smaller kind of artist-run venues and collectives. And so Tempest Project really was that. It was sort of an artist-run exhibition space, collective. And so I basically got the Tampa Museum to finance both the 33 and a third performed by audience installation that we did, and also then this satellite project that we could kind of open at the same time. Very because nice. that small, again, artist-run organization didn't have any money. They certainly couldn't hire me. And we kind of decided then to make the Cage tribute exhibition in this little garage space that was theirs. Because of the connection with the Tampa Museum, it ended up getting lots of attention, and they benefited quite a lot from also the visiting artists. Because, you know, when we opened that show, much to my amazement, we had not only kind of the promotion of those projects by the artists who were participating, but also then Christian Marclay, an artist with whom I've done a good bit of work and been a big fan of. Christian flew in from London and he was there to work at Graphic Studio, but also participated in all of the opening events and had, in fact, also been involved in the Tampa Museum portion of the exhibition in terms of the selection of records, which I know we'll talk about. But Christian was there, and Emil Schult from the band Kraftwerk, who was sort of the artist in Kraftwerk, but who contributed Kraftwerk's personal records to part of the installation. And then Emil remarkably came and trained the docents at the Tampa Museum on how to use the record player. So at least they could advise people as people entered 33 and a third, just as I think Cage had done originally, you know, to have people there as support. So yeah, that said, I think that's when we first made contact, and it was really remarkable to me that you were so responsive and also so generous, both in helping me and encouraging me, because I know that it was a bit of a stretch in what we were proposing based on the original score and how Cage had in fact done the project prior.
You have, Jade, listened to a number of the programs that I've done. I'll say it again because I've said it a few times, and that is that the, you know, when we made the Cage Trust, it was less about being fussy and interested in what Cage did, but what he's doing now. What is Cage doing now? And that is to say that I consider 33 and a third by Jay Dillinger, which is very different than what Cage did, as really what is Cage doing now? You know, so it isn't as far afield as one might think, although purists might, their nettles might bristle, you know.
Yeah. As you probably recognized as we were having our initial correspondence about that. And it really wasn't, I mean, in terms of us meeting in person, as that project happened at the Tampa Museum, then of course I traveled it to the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, and we can talk more about that. But and it was really that you came and we did a conversation with the then director, Ron Bishop, in the gallery. But had you said at any point at the beginning, like, no, this is out of bounds, like you're extending this, I certainly would have gone back to a kind of randomly selected records. But it seemed clear to me, I think, in our exchanges initially too, that both it had often been described as any 300 or any 250 records. One, you had all of these questions because in 1969, when the piece was performed, of course, it was a very different installation than during Cage's lifetime, when René Bloch had invited him to do the project in Berlin. And even there, the blacking out of the record labels and the naked vinyl and all of those things, I think, you know, I think have become the accepted form largely because, of course, you know, that was kind of the final version in the late 80s while Cage was participating and alive. But and they've been memorialized and or kept in the form of it being then acquired by the museum in Germany. All of that said, I sort of felt like because this was both a celebration and because, you know, it was truly meant to sort of honor him, that we would do so by, you know, having the any records. And I guess also I had heard, I think, from you during that time that you that your understanding of it had been that Cage had reached out to a local record store and had asked to have those records given or donated, or I guess maybe purchased, but that he hadn't stipulated the content of the records nor the condition of the records, right?
That's correct. That's correct. He didn't, he actually said, sell me, I think it's 300. I think he said, sell me 300 records that you're having a hard time selling.
There you go.
You know, people say, oh, chance, therefore nothing is controlled. That's certainly not true. Parameters are created around chance. That's always the case. But let's go back. I just want to know.
Well, and certainly about that, I understood that. But my feeling was, in that sense, the curator of the records was the record shop owner, right? I mean, he determined what those records would be when he provided them to Cage. So I felt like our proposing this idea of records selected, even it wasn't by me, even the idea that it's sort of 30 people that have connections to Cage or not, but that were both visual artists and his collaborators. And again, we can talk in detail about that and the content of those records, but and why they approached it, because often John Baldessari, who picked records, turned to Phil Curtis, his archivist, and said, go to my personal record collection and at random pick 10 records. But others, you know, Blixa Bargeld from Einsturz and Neubauten said, has anyone chosen Cage records? And of course, I responded with no, actually, we haven't had anyone choose a Cage record. And so he said, I want mine all to be Cage records. So, and with David Byrne, who was one of the first people I really contacted about everything, for him, it was important that the human voice became a part of, in addition to the sound of those who were participating, he picked only spoken word records and really remarkable, fantastic stuff. So it was T.S. Eliot reading or Wild Man Fisher, you know.
Right, so, right. Interesting, Jade, that David Byrne had relationship with Rauschenberg, which you didn't quite, right? At this point in your career, you may have met, but you had nothing to do with the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at that early stage, right?
True, yeah. Well, all of it kind of connects in a funny way. I mean, in terms of, you know, the story that I kind of tell here, since because of this Cage exhibition that I traveled from the Tampa Museum and meeting you and meeting Ron Bishop and the success of it, in that we also had, for the first time, I think, keeping in mind, Bob died in 2008, right? So there was a memorial here and family and friends came. There were 1,000 people who showed up. Dickie Landry performed. We had a kind of remarkable thing that went on here. I was not a participant in that, but I knew about the Rauschenberg Gallery a little bit. And what was wonderful was when I proposed bringing the show here, one of our dear mutual friends who's been a guest on your program, Ron actually hired Lawrence Wojtek to help me with the installation. Uh-huh. So I was sort of set for the week where, you know, Ron was occasionally present, but it was Lawrence and I like determining the chance part of the installation. And I was getting an earful of the history of the gallery and Bob's connection, and that this was sort of a laboratory, and that, you know, this extraordinary, you know, background, because of course, as I think you've mentioned prior, but, you know, Bob, since the late 60s and really officially in December 69, early 70, moved to Captiva Island quite close by. At the beginning, he had the small studio where I think you initially, he hosted you.
The beach house.
The beach house, which then across was the small studio. And he was building these ambitious things that he'd never get to see until they were at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm. And so ultimately in 1979, when this building was built, a humanities hall, the college had decided that they wanted to have a dedicated space, but to do it properly. There wasn't in Southwest Florida a climate controlled, high security environment for presenting important works of art or valuable works of art. So they connected with the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian had their sites, Smithsonian Institute traveling exhibitions. And to be a sites qualified site, you actually had to meet all of these, you know, demands. And so the first exhibition to be presented in the Rauschenberg Gallery was coming from the Smithsonian. That was all predetermined. And that's when they approached Bob. And I think Bob got excited by the idea that at long last, there was a place that he could kind of connect to. It was also the case that at that point, he'd have to go to Tampa even to get a flight out of town. So it was a 2-hour drive off the island, that sort of thing. And so in the inaugural season here, 42 years ago now, Bob had a big solo exhibition. He would use this, he didn't like people walking up off the beach and interrupting work, but you know, this would be a place for him to meet and greet. And also he managed then to sort of world premiere very major things, like the 1/4-mile, 2-furlong piece was done in 3 parts here over 3 years at times for a weekend or two for one section, right? So there was that kind of extraordinary history. But the Rauschenberg Gallery, after his death, there wasn't another Rauschenberg show. And I think Ron did very wonderful programming during Bob's lifetime with him, very closely, doing also with you the Cage exhibition here that was a sort of seminal exhibition in 2002, and then an exhibition of Merce and the work related to Merce and Rauschenberg as well, those three within the context of a year. But after Bob's death, I think he didn't know how to really make a Rauschenberg exhibition without Bob's presence. And that was understood. So 4 years later, when I traveled this exhibition down and you flew in, you were, I think, on vacation anyway, but you came and you participated and were incredibly generous about that and seemed enthusiastic about what we had done. I think Ron realized, one, that the old Rauschenberg crew turned out. Sonic Combine played, Daryl Podorf, all of the people in his most intimate circle who had not really been in the gallery in 4 years came. So within the year.
Interesting. And they hadn't left.
They were all local, yeah. But they really didn't have reason, I think, to connect to the gallery much at that point. So within the year, basically what happened was I was sort of adamantly this, you know, independent curator. The shows that I would do for the Contemporary Art Museum in Tampa, we would then travel to other places. So they'd go to MoCA, Miami, they'd go to the Contemporary Art Museum in Cincinnati. And, you know, I felt very comfortable in that context. They would hire me based on the projects I'd be pitching. But that said, Ron calls me within the year. He says, I've been here 14 years. I'm retiring. And you should know that anything, I know you're not looking for a job, that sort of thing. But, you know, I think you'd bring an energy to this and it would be a tabula rasa. It'd be a clean slate. You could get Bob back into the gallery, the connection with Cage, all of these things could be explored, plus the artist that I had had 20 years of kind of being connected with and working with. So that's essentially how I came to, you know, become the director here, but also for me, it was very tied to both having done this Cage thing that included Bob, and also in thinking back, you were asking or talking to about even the title, Things Not Seen Before. That really goes back to my first correspondence with Cage. So with Rauschenberg, the story that I always tell about my arrival here and participation here, it has to do with my having written Bob a fan letter. And at the same time, really, I was doing the same with Cage. So it's a little self-indulgent to talk about this, but essentially I had a great grandfather who was a baseball Hall of Famer. He carried the heaviest bat in baseball. He went into the Hall of Fame with Jackie Robinson in 1962. He lived until I was 20. So I knew him well. He was well into his 90s and in very good physical condition, except that he had cataracts and he continued to suffer cataracts. So our routine was often on the weekends, I would come for a visit. I was growing up north of Tampa. We would come down to Bradenton where he had a home. And our sort of thing that we would do together that we would bond over was that I would read his fan mail. And he would get, you know, dozens of letters in a week. And often for me, that was very important because, you know, by the time I came to the realization as a very young person, my first museum experience had actually been going to the Baseball Hall of Fame Museum in Cooperstown. And that was one of those experiences where, you know, he was immediately pulled aside to sign autographs and to participate with the other Hall of Famers.
How old
and
were
I
you?
Sort of grew, I must have been 7 or 8, yeah, maybe 9. And I didn't know that he was this major figure, but I kind of grew up then around Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and Yogi Berra and all of these people. But as soon as we got to the Baseball Hall of Fame, I was pulled aside by the director of the museum because I could, you know, he had to go do his business and meet and greet with people. So she then, as I recall, as a child, took me through the exhibitions, and it was going past all of these trophies and uniforms. And we got to this vitrine where she said, this is something very special that you should take note of. This is, and it was my granddad's like dirty old baseball cap, one of his bats, like his dirty cleats. And as a kid, for me, it was one of these things where it was like, I was in the same room with him last night and we got dressed together. He helped me with my shoes and we got out the door. So I think that had a profound impact in terms of thinking about how museums determine the value of objects and why they're historically significant and how we create these narratives around these objects, all of that, which set me on my path in a way. But additionally, because I was growing up in Lando Lakes, Florida, I felt completely away from, as I started to get interested in art in high school, I felt completely detached from what might be happening in New York or elsewhere in the world with these artists. And even though Bob was only a few hours down the road, it seemed like a million miles. So I had read an article at the time where the interviewer had actually gone to Captiva and Bob had taken him or her to the Mucky Duck, as it turns out, to this bar, and, you know, where he could just walk the beach, basically, as you know, and explained. And they wrote in the article that, you know, this was his sort of daily activity, that he would walk down, watch the sunset, was a big drinker, and kind of would have a drink watching the sunset. And that was a sort of celebratory every evening event. So seeing all of these creative letters that would come to my great grandfather, it was really quick and kind of easy then to know if someone had a genuine interest or if they were an autograph dealer sending a dozen baseballs to get signatures to sell. And because of that, I thought, well, baseball players are not my heroes, but I'm really getting interested in art. And Rauschenberg was one. Cage was another, but much less on my radar at that moment. So I wrote Bob a fan letter, essentially, and I sent it instead of to RR Captiva, which would have, you know, they would have knocked on his door. I sent it to Mr. Robert Rauschenberg, care of the Mucky Duck Pub. And so even then at 14, 15 years old, knowing fully that, you know, as soon as he walked in, they say, Bob, you are here way too often. You're getting your mail here. Here you go. There's some letter from some kid. But then in it, as he would have opened and read, I said, P.S. enclosed is $10. Let me buy you a drink. Right. So I think, you know, being the big drinker that he was, that impressed probably the bar. And he also, you know, then immediately responded, which amazed me, because we get a knock on the door in Land O'Lakes, Florida. My mother answers and says, Jade, the postman's here for you. And had a big package, a big tube, canceled Captiva. And in it was a handwritten note from Bob that said, I'll have that drink and wish you luck just before I go to work tonight. I've put a gift in your pocket, best RR, and then had sent me this lithographic poster. He had just come back from China. So, and it was inscribed for Jade, you know, Bob Rauschenberg kind of thing. So that was my first opportunity to kind of connect with Bob. In grad school, I did do an interview with him, but it was through Bradley and kind of, again, via fax. And I was doing an article for a British publication, but I was probably in the room with him 2 or 3 times over the years, and always too timid to actually introduce myself. And then similarly with Cage, essentially then it had to be my freshman year in college, I began to have a deeper understanding of how influential Cage had been to both Rauschenberg and to Johns. And in much the same way, I started doing some research having to do with additions. And because I had by then begun to go to school at the University of South Florida, where Graphic Studio is. And Graphic Studio is this print atelier that was set up by Donald Saff that was one of the things that really had enticed Rauschenberg. And ultimately, it's the reason Jim Rosenquist moved to Florida, was because they would come and they would work on many, many edition projects. And it was a very open, not burdened by kind of commercial interest. They had a subscribership. Bob did, I don't know, maybe 50 editions, as did Rauschenberg, or as did Rosenquist there. And so as a sort of freshman, then sophomore at the University of South Florida, I started doing research around Graphic Studio. I was aware of it. I really didn't intend to end up in my hometown where I'd grown up to be in Tampa, but it was sort of too enticing, and they were preparing for the National Gallery's retrospective of Graphic Studio at that time. So I started doing this sort of summer research project, and I started reaching out to artists. I had been told, of course, by my professor instructor that by the end of this, you know, you can talk to printers, you can talk to people involved that are employed by the studio. And then by the end, maybe we'll set you up with an interview with one of the artists, if things go well, if you don't embarrass yourself or us. So I immediately within that, after that initial meeting, to impress my professor, who was also became the director of the museum and is now the director of the Museum and Graphic Studio, Margaret Miller, to impress her, I walked away from that meeting and said, I can find a phone number for someone. I'm going to start just setting up my own interviews. So I called Robert Motherwell, first person, and much to my amazement, he answered the phone, and it was kind of this extraordinary conversation. Super naive, had really ridiculously simplistic questions. But what I did do, I think then, and he thought to my credit, I at the end of the conversation, I had transcribed everything and I sent it to him. And I said, I so appreciate you allowing me this interview, this telephone interview, and that it will be super helpful for my research. And oh yes, I will find those monographs about you. I've only to date read the couple of paragraphs in my general, you know, Janssen history of art, but and his catalog resumes on his prints and all of the things that I had not, you know, really tapped into that I should have had I been properly prepared. But when I sent this and I sent the transcript of our conversation, within then a week or so, I got a letter back from Motherwell with completely retyped, I believe by him, with corrections in his hand and a letter saying, because you were so honorable in sending me the transcript, know that I don't really do interviews at this point in my life and career, but I have granted you one, consider it a gift. and wow. He actually then in a thoughtful way took my questions and, you know, gave me proper written answers, right? It wasn't a lengthy, but that said, I went back in and with my then advisor instructor and said, oh, by the way, I interviewed Robert Motherwell since our last meeting 2 weeks ago. But with that, I did find through this undergraduate research that in just ambitiously contacting artists and saying I was a student, many of them were quite open. So I was able to, you know, have exchanges with Jasper Johns and with Rauschenberg and with a number of Jim Rosenquist, then ultimately in person a number of times and that kind of thing. But John Cage, I ended up sort of sending a short questionnaire, and it was like very simple questions. And this would have been about 1987. And in his response, there was one that had to do with, you know, Rauschenberg and Johns and sort of pop art, you know, versus Neo Dada, something about. And in his response, he said, I'm honored to have known Marcel Duchamp and to still be living in the time of Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. He said, I'm not interested in the names of these things. I'm interested in things not seen before and seeing and making things not seen before. So that really was my first exchange with him, but also became kind of the title of this tribute. So that's really where that had come from.
So talk a little bit, stop there, because I'd be interested for our listeners to hear you talk about, this is where I entered your life, in fact, I think, yeah, right away, was the fact that you were a collector of strange, yeah, objects. You were a person who kept their eye to the ground on just stuff that looked interesting. And you ended up with a couple of things of relating to John Cage that turned out to be really, really special, which you ended, yeah, up putting in that show.
I did. That's right. Yes, yeah. Well, the thing about the exchange with Cage, and actually in part my motivation was had to do with my own embarrassment, I guess, and also deep feelings of kind of guilt. And that really went back to, and I loved later, of course, reading when Laurie Anderson interviewed Cage for Tricycle Magazine. Laurie did ask him about his process and also about his mail and how he handled his mail. And I know you know that story well, but essentially, you know, he said that he had found simpler ways to compose, and it allowed him more time as well to respond to the mail, because he felt like every phone call, every letter could be the Buddha, or could be, I mean, it was this idea that everyone is equally important. And as I know that you've said, even on this program prior, when you talked about your time with Rauschenberg, you know, that he had just had a call from the Dalai Lama, but he treated you equally well. And it was the same conversation, right? So my understanding about that with Cage was, you know, and then reading this description from Laurie, or from Cage to Laurie Anderson and Tricycle, you know, in some ways unburdened me, and but also in doing this exhibition, because one of the tricks that I'd learned from the letters that would come to my great grandfather, and when I first tried to write Cage, essentially fan letter and then kind of questionnaire with a few small questions, was that if you sent these things via registered mail, they had to deal with it, like they would have to sign for, or they would have to. And in the first, or a later exchange, actually, and I can talk more about it, but there was a project that I began while I was making contact with artists, and it was kind of a beginning of collecting as well. But there was a book that was produced that Eric Fischel and Jerry Saltz had done called this, A Sketchbook with Voices. And I don't know if I've told you that, but it was essentially an empty sketchbook with quotes from artists that were kind of instruction. And it was something that when my parents gave it to me in high school, I think they thought I was going to be an artist and that I would start immediately to take the assignments and to fill them in with my drawings. But I was quickly going down the path of being a curator. So in a sense, as I was making contact with artists, I decided that those that had been most responsive to me and most generous with me, Keith Haring, for example, and Kenny Scharf, and some of those people that loved interacting with sort of fans and kids. And I thought I would send this book around and have them do these projects. And so Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf, all of these people started to do drawings in this book, and it was beginning to circulate. And much to my amazement, as I made contact with people, and I actually have it with, but I had managed to get Ed Ruscha to do things, William Wegman to do things, incredible people. Saul LeWitt made a drawing on the page that he had given instruction for. And then I thought, how am I going to wrap up this project at the end? And so I sent a note to Cage saying, you know, I'm circulating this book. Would you consider having a look at it? And if you felt motivated, that maybe you would contribute to the book as well. And he generously said, send the book. And then as I sent the book, he held it for some time. But eventually I got both the book and a letter back. And in the letter, he explained how he was working on the Harvard lectures and other things were going on that you were very engaged with, obviously, but that he had had the opportunity and found great interest in looking through the book. Could that be his Duchampian contribution? Was that he had spent time with it, essentially. So I wrote him back, you know, saying, absolutely, you know, I'd be honored. And in it, at the back of the book, he inscribed the book with essentially, well, just says, I've looked through this book, John Cage, but in the letter, and it's dated 1988, but in the letter back to me, there was a PS, and it said, in the future, please be so kind as not to register your mail. It forces me to walk to the post office, which I, you know, to this day, I mean, I feel such guilt over that I was forcing him. And again, it was just a strategy to, you know, make my ridiculously unimportant correspondence seem more so.
I have a very, very cute story about the post office right up the street from John's house. So I would be the one for, in that period, this same period when John would go on tour, and Merce was often on tour. So I would stay there. And John would leave me his photo ID or whatever it was that he had so that I could, any mail that got held, I could go get it. And I remember vividly this one time going up to that very post office on 18th Street and 7th Avenue, walking in there, going to the desk where you collect something and saying, I work with the composer, John Cage. Here's his ID. He's touring. You have something for him. And I remember vividly this day where the post guy took the ID from me, started to walk away, and then turned around and said, hey, isn't this that guy that writes that creepy music? I was so relieved, Jade, that she acknowledged that I could get the mail, that I said, And then I said, No.
We don't have time for all of that.
Right. But I was so glad that he knew who this person was. And I was so moved. And he said something, it was so kind to me, something like, oh, don't worry about me. I don't like anything after Debussy, you know, or something.
Oh.
Like that. But it's very funny.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing story. Great. You know, that's very Cage. You know, he was always trying to do what people, he once told me, if you want to get someone off your back, do what they ask you to do. You know, so somebody keeps writing to you and saying, that's how his first writings on James Joyce came about. Because he kept being bothered by these people who wanted him to do something. And he finally said, all right, and did whatever it was that they wanted him to do.
So, agreed. Wow.
I kind of, you know, I take that to heart nowadays, you know, that if somebody wants you to do something and you really don't want to, if they come back again, it's probably in your best interest to just do it.
To say yes.
Don't go away. You know?
Right. Absolutely. Oh, well, and then I made my way to New York, essentially, in terms of all of this. And I was really lucky in terms of the timing of that. It was at that moment when, and I love the program you did with Julie Lazar, but it was at the time that was being organized. I was coming up from Florida, and actually my girlfriend, who had been a grad student at the time, had moved to Los Angeles, and she was assisting Julie Lazar on that show.
Who was it?
Her name was Stacia Payne, and Stacia was, you know, involved having the opportunity to travel to New York some, I think usually with Julie. And I was then arriving in New York to go to graduate school, but it was at a moment when the first time I was in the room and able to sort of see him perform was when he did, I guess it must have been Empty Words 4 at a section of it at Paula Cooper Gallery with the SEM Ensemble. And then a couple of months later, because I had gone up in my senior year as an undergrad and had done a program at Drew University, I had an internship. And when offered opportunities to do this internship at some of the bigger museums, I then decided that at this time, the Whitney had these branch museums, right? So there were various branches at Philip Morris and at the Equitable Center. And the staffs at those smaller museums were quite intimate. Like maybe there'd be a curator, maybe there'd be a director. And Adam Weinberg, who then became the director of the Whitney, but Adam was the director of the Equitable branch. So I, as an intern, was there. And then Cage, a couple of months after this Paula Cooper thing, performed the James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and Alphabet.
I was there. We probably saw each other across the room.
I was hiding in the back and really confused by all of it, I'm sure. But that was a big thing for me because, too, I think I must have gotten tickets because I was the intern, and you know, it was one of those things. In retrospect, I wish I had known then what I know now in terms of even those performers, because Philip Korner and Dick Higgins and all of these people were a part of that. I mean,
that's correct. The performers were all friends. Whole thing was put together by Klaus Schoening at the WDR in Cologne, who was so much a part of Cage's life throughout the last, say, 20 years of it. And he had put that together.
Incredible. And they did it first in Germany or something too, right? Because it was a commission
from the WDR, yeah. And it was a radio work.
As
and
a radio work.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Anyway, it's been fun to revisit that as I've worked now closely and done an exhibition here with Phil Korner and things since. I mean, part of my programming with the Rauschenberg Gallery has certainly been heavily influenced both by Cage and by those he influenced. So the follow-up, and as I became the director of the gallery 8 years ago, was to do then to work with Kevin Concannon to do an exhibition of Yoko.
I remember Yoko that exhibition well. I loved that show. That was really special.
It was really such a treat, and she made work and also, you know, billboard projects, which she's continued to do for us, which has been lovely. But the connection for me with Yoko too was that she also had picked records for that 33 and a third installation. She was the one artist, I think, that picked only her records and John Lennon's records. But she was also wonderful in that as soon as the project launched at the Tampa Museum, all of a sudden Yoko was tweeting this to 6 million followers.
Of course, so her 6 million closest friends.
Yes, and it blew up, I mean, much to my amazement. And it was incredible. I mean, it just spoke to me in doing that, organizing that project, which we have since toured. I mean, it has been, it led to the second installation of that collection of records in the form of, or as part of a Cage tribute exhibition, then happened in Tbilisi, Georgia. So I did it at the National Gallery in Georgia.
I got the tote bag.
You did, oh, that's right. That's right. Well, and that was such an odd experience because, you know, all of these like old Russian record players and whatever they could gather from friends. But all the records went by a diplomatic pouch because we had the U.S. State Department sort of sponsoring it all, which was great. But yeah, it's continued to kind of have a life. But that core group that selected the records to me, and now many are deceased this now 10 years later, really did so in such a thoughtful way. I mean, again, back to kind of talking about 33 and a third, but, you know, I asked Jim Rosenquist to pick records and he did, and John Baldessari, of course, and Ed Ruscha, and then people like Meredith Monk and like Pauline Oliveros and Iggy Pop and, you know, who... Many of them.
I think that part of why we were not fussy about your doing that, that is to say curating this the way you did, was because it was Cage's centennial. It was an appropriate time to reach out to all these people who knew Cage far better than I did, you know, or longer, certainly, and reaching out to them and saying, do you want to do something? It was a way to bring in people who were fully engaged in their careers. You know, they really didn't have time to do something Cage centric, you know what I mean? But picking 10 LPs, you bet.
Yeah.
We, you know, of that age, all of us, you know, me and Mimi and Yoko and all of us, you know, we grew up in the age of LPs, you know, of recordings. So we certainly had a lifetime of those to spare.
Right. Well, and everyone approached it in sort of different interesting ways. I mean, you know, like, again, Jack White pressed records, you know, we had, and he had no real connection to Cage, but I think an understanding. And you had, you know, Christian Markley, who then came in and having experienced first, having been in the Broken Music show, you know, and being in Berlin, he decided that it should be Naked Vinyl, and also that he wanted just a random selection of red vinyl records. So he created a kind of box just filled with red vinyl Naked records. Mm-hmm. And he didn't, again, care about the content. So it was Christmas records, or it was, you know, some odd Valentine's records, or the Beatles on red vinyl, or Devo.
Right.
So, and Christian then did come. And I mean, you know, there wasn't any of it that was sort of planned or staged. I mean, but as Christian was there at the opening, he did sort of kick things off by, when people were timid at the Tampa Museum initially to interact, I mean, they sort of knew, you know, that they were there to participate in something, but was it an opening or was it, were, and what were they to look at? They were sort of flipping through the bins.
Right.
Christian immediately went over and grabbed a pile of his red vinyl and put it on all the record players and turned them all on.
Right.
And that really kind of began and became kind of the kickoff for the whole project, you know.
Right.
So
I just want to interject something here for our listening audience, because they might not think of this, but the fact of the matter is that 33 and a third, like Cage's Music Circus, which I've done a program about, those are two works in Cage's catalog where there is no copyright control, because the content, if you will, of those two pieces is all over the place. That C.F. Peters, Cage's music publisher, doesn't hold copyright to any of that and couldn't know what it is anyway. So
absolutely,
those two pieces, you know, we say, go for it. You want to do it? Go for it. It's, you know,
well,
it's, those are freebies, so to speak.
and remarkable. I mean, I do think, you know, that's been such a popular piece, also obviously because of the participatory nature of it. And it's just such fun to, you know, to be engaged with. It was interesting to me, actually, that as we went through and were receiving lists or people sending their personal records, or as we were compiling that kind of collection of records, that in listening to that first bit of recording that is the little bit of existing documentation of that you played last week on the program, the things that I begin to identify at the beginning of it, it sounded a lot to me like there was some Miles Davis something that was happening. And even in our installation, Jim Rosenquist had picked a record by Miles Davis, and Brian Ferry, who had been in Roxy Music, had actually picked the Velvet Underground and Nico. And that, to me, in listening to that recording, was the first identifiable voice, was hearing Lou Reed and, you know, doing Heroin. It was sort of, they took that particular album with the Andy Warhol, you know, banana cover, and put it on the B-side, you know, so I don't know if that 40 plus minutes that you played last week is at the very beginning or somewhere in the middle.
Right. But I don't, you know, I don't know. That was just in Cage's holdings. So who knows? He left it behind.
Yeah.
But you raised an interest, I guess, a similarity or something, although it's records, where, you know, Cage had no feeling for records, really.
Right.
He does a lovely quote, wherein he says, throw all the records away and somebody in Texas will learn to sing.
Ah.
I really like, isn't that nice?
That's great.
But as you were talking, it made me think of what we used to playfully, even when Cage was alive, we playfully called the aha factor. And the aha factor, you saw it at work with his Your Operas 1 and 2, because people were sitting in this audience watching an opera unfold for 2.5 hours that was made up of things that had fallen into public domain that could be performed without cost. Otherwise, it'd be frightfully expensive to do. But people would say, oh, that's Mozart. Oh, that's Mirage of Figaro. That's, you know, these little snippets. And you're talking about that just the way that people, opera enthusiasts, did when they were watching Cage's Your Operas 1 and 2. Here you have 33 and a third with all these snippets of records, of LPs from decades prior, you know, that people of all ages might connect to in one way or another.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Well,
did Cage and Cunningham, did they have a record player in the apartment?
No.
They did not. So they didn't, they never collected records. They never had.
No. Yeah. Cage kept any records that were sent to him, but then would give them away. He gave most records. Bill Anastasi, the artist in New York, still with us.
Brilliant.
Bill would come over all the time to play chess with John. And every now and then, John would say, don't you want to go through my records? There's a few new things, you know. And Bill would just take whatever he wanted.
Cage Please
didn't
take
have
them.
A record player. He did have a small tape player. So he would often get cassettes. That's the period. CDs were on the edge. He died in 92. I think the first CD I ever got was 3 months after he died. But cassette tapes, people sent him cassettes all the time.
Well, it's interesting that they do play a role. I mean, you know, as we're also now preparing for a project at Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center in Asheville. And I know you've had Jeff Arnell as a guest as well. And we will be restaging 33 and a third, but thinking about both the history at Black Mountain, you know, with Theater Piece Number 1, he had Rauschenberg playing a record player, did he not?
Of course he did. Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. You and I suspect, and you know, so much known about the theater piece, number one, right, is anecdotal. So we really don't know what the conversations were. Everybody's dead, so we can't talk to them. But, you know, I venture a guess that John was like, Bob, what could you do? You could play a record player. We'll get a record player for you. You know, it wasn't like they had a deep love of records. It was more an action that they could do that was visible and doable.
Yeah. He had at least one, but Edith Piaf record is what I understood. And Lawrence says he remembers reading or hearing something about how Bob had intentionally scratched up the record as well. So
It sounds like Bob tells the story.
And then the owner of the record apparently was very angry at the end when he got the record back, and Bob had just, you know, really torn it apart. So
Oh dear.
but similar, it seems, I mean, in terms of thinking then about 33 and a third, I mean, you know, cause in a way, was it not also the situation where, you know, he wanted people to be able to interact freely. Everyone knew how to play a record player, but not everyone could play guitar. So had he filled the room with instruments, it would not
have. And it was the instrument of the people, you know, so to speak. Yeah. A guitar was as well, because you could just strum it open stringed, but, you know, a record player. And, you know, also Cage, you know, and again, I never asked him this because it never crossed my mind, and maybe until now, but, you know, I wonder if it was, do you remember in the Radio Happenings, did you ever read the Radio Happenings with Morton Feldman?
I haven't, actually.
I sent you a copy. I think I have extra copies. Yeah. If I do, I'll send you one. But in there, he talks, Morty Feldman is complaining about all the transistor radios on the beach, and it's ruining his experience of nature. And John takes everything that his good friend says to heart. And he says, well, I think you should think about doing what I did. And Morty says, what's that? And John says, I made a piece for transistor radios, for, you know, handheld radios. And now whenever I hear a radio, I think, oh, they're playing my piece. You know, so I just wonder if his dislike of records was behind the creation of 33 and a third, where let's make a piece with these LPs where things are repeated, played over and over and over and over, you know, that all of a sudden when he hears records, or when he heard records after the fact, he would say, they're playing my piece, 33 and a third.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know, but I, you know, it's certainly feasible.
Well, quite like 433 too, right? I mean, that was the
that was the largest example of that,
right?
33 and a third also, you know, I think it also had this byproduct of it, which was probably maybe more than just a byproduct, but it was a reflection of something, you know. Just like yours was, even though yours was so fully curated relative to Cage's, which was just give me 300, you know, but it was a reflection of something, of its period. Like, you know, what were the records that were played? What was chosen by people? What was randomly gathered by someone, you know?
Or even available, right? I mean, versus now, because so of course, anything posthumous would not have been possible.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, let's do talk a little bit more about Black Mountain Museum and Arts Center, because that's coming up, and it would be really nice to know that I'm going to do something. I haven't decided what I'm doing yet, but I am. You're going to be there because you're doing 33 and a third. You're also going to put up Things Not Seen Before.
Calling the exhibition Don't Blame It on Zen, because this is part of the Way of John Cage and Friends, because this is all very connected to the University of North Carolina, to Rick Chess, who is at the Faith and Arts Institute there. So they're doing, you know, within the context of their sort of religious studies, the focus will be on Buddhism more broadly. And so in many ways, the exhibition that we're trying to begin to put together is Cage's circle once again. So it's a little bit of tribute to Cage. There will certainly be work by Cage, and 33 and a third will be in the middle. We had conversations again about trying to do Allison's Bean Garden, which is a sound piece.
Allison Knowles.
Allison Knowles.
For those who don't know who Allison is.
not Allison Higgins. So because that was the funny thing. Actually, we didn't really talk about the conch, but on the conch, when I showed it to Allison Knowles, I did an exhibition that Phil Korner titled. It was about Fluxus music, but he titled it Fluzuzic in a very James Joycean sort of way. For that exhibition, all of those that were still living with us then, Jeffrey Hendricks and Phil, and participated and made new work, and Yoko, and I invited Allison Knowles to Florida, to the gallery, and she decided that she wanted us to collaborate on building the largest version of her Bean Garden, which is historically dates back to the avant-garde festivals of Charlotte Moorman. And she had done a small version that was essentially what would be kind of look like a sandbox, but filled with dried beans that people could walk through. And it's also an instrument in that it has a platform underneath with its microphone. So you hear the sounds of the footsteps as you're walking through. But generally speaking, that's been a one or two person experience where you're walking through, you know, these beans. It's very meditative. It's very tactile. You have this, it's actually therapeutic on your feet because you're taking your shoes off and it feels wonderful.
It's like it's like free reflexology.
Absolutely. I mean, it feels remarkable. It's really fantastic the longer you spend in. But in the conversation with Allison in advance of that exhibition, I sort of said, well, how about we make it a really communal experience, and we make it for, you know, 8 or 10 people? Like, let's make a giant bean box, right? So so she agreed, and we ended up using local juniper and building this beautiful box and having it microphoned. And she came down to perform in it to sort of kick everything off and to, you know, bring her bean turners and all of that. And one of the things I sort of surprised her with was showing her these artist conchs, as I learned was this term for these mushrooms that I had managed to track down some years ago, and I think was part of our making contact originally as well.
Jane, we're totally out of
time. We got to go.
Totally out of time. I'd like to propose that this is Laura Kuhn Talks with Jane Dellinger, part one.
Wow.
And we do a part two, because we haven't talked about your work with Steps, with the Ray Cass John Cage project. You really have not talked about Things Not Seen Before, which almost needs its own show. So I'd like us to bid our audience adieu today and stay tuned, and let's do another show where we can pick up where we have to leave off.
I would love that. It's so nice to see you. Would love that. Sure.
Excellent. Okay. For our listening audience, tune back in next Saturday night, July 10, for Laura Kuhn and Jay Dellinger, part two.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.